Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest Book Reporter Talks To interview, where our guest today is Lisa Scottolini, and we are going to be talking about her latest work of historical fiction, Loyalty, here, which I have behind me. She has behind her. Kristen Hannah had this to say about it: a powerful, poignant exploration about the rise of the mafia in Sicily. Lisa Scottolini's Loyalty is a gripping, compulsively readable tale of courage, loyalty, family secrets, and the price of honor. An unputdownable piece of historical fiction that puts Scottolini's talent for writing twisty plots and unforgettable characters on full display. And with that, welcome, Lisa.
It was so nice of her. I'm such a fan of her work, and I just am very, very honored by these wonderful, you know, blurbs coming in and reviews. Because, you know, Carol, I read them online.
I do.
I'm on Goodreads. I check everything because I care what people think. I'm not going to pretend that I don't. And in some ways, historical fiction is new for me and a departure for me. And this is even a departure from Eternal, which I think was fairly well received. So I'm delighted. I count my blessings when something like that comes in. I count my blessings. Yeah. That's a blessing.
We also got a vote from my husband, Tom Fitzgerald. So there you go. Yeah. A real reader who doesn't read all the blurbs and doesn't know what everybody's talking about. So there you go. Pre-printing. I should get him to do a blurb. We could put it someplace, you know? If you do, like, it's very good. I enjoyed it. You know what I mean? Nothing but power.
Tom's seal of approval.
So this is your second work of historical fiction. What inspired you to write Loyalty?
You know, there were so many things, but part of it was that I've always loved fiction about justice. Mm-hmm. And that includes mob movies. Like, I love The Godfather and Scarface and that, all about that. But I have to be real with you that I'm Italian-American. As an Italian-American, previously I was a lawyer. So when you're a lawyer and you have an Italian, there's a little bit of a stigma that exists about Italian-Americans because of mob movies. And I was like, Lisa, don't be a hypocrite. What is the attraction of a mob movie, even though you know that this is in the zeitgeist? And part of it is that I was like, well, I'm always feeling like a little bit, you want to set the record straight as an Italian American. You want to say, there's nothing about Italians per se. Mm-hmm. It's not in the Italian DNA that makes you a mobster. I'm a lawyer and I believe in justice. But that made me think about Sicily, because Sicily is where the mafia was born. And I started to read more about the 1800s in Sicily, which is when the mafia was born. And I was like, the inspiration was try to understand why then and why there.
Right.
And that gave rise to Loyalty.
That's the kernel of the story. So you traveled to Sicily for research, and I think it was October 2021.
Right. Not that last year. Was that 20? It was last year.
Last year. 2022. Yes. 2022.
Right.
So that's right. No, I think it's 2021, but I
don't even know.
But it's one of the Octobers.
Never leave the house. The last time I left the house, I went to Sicily.
Exactly.
Okay. You know how that happens, as one does.
Had you written anything before that trip? As in, did you already have the bones of the story in mind? Or were you going there just to get there and feel and say, what am I going to write from here?
The latter, because I'm a spontaneous kind of girl, or also impatient. Like, I have bad study habits. I don't want to know what I'm going to write. I don't really know what I'm going to write. I knew it was mob related. But then when I got there, for example, I started learning stuff. And believe me, I did a lot of reading before, and also reading period fiction, which is really important if you're going to try to write it, you know. But what I started to learn, for example, when I went there, so I went, all right, I know I'm going to have a mafia guy. How does the mafia start? And by the way, the word mafia comes because in Sicilian dialect, it means you're very proud, you're very bold, you're kind of attractive and sexy. To be very mafia, that's what it meant originally. Uh-huh. So interesting. I know, I didn't know that until I went there.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
I go there, then I learned, for example, that at the same time the mafia is rising, there's another organization rising, and they're a secret organization of aristocrats. It's like a secret little club that met in Palermo, the capital where I went. And they met in the basement of this church, and they were do-gooders. They were just people concerned about the rising crime in Palermo, because the police force was corrupt and kind of bought by the colonizers and nobility. And so they, doctors, lawyers, they would meet to try to do good. And I said, well, that's, and I didn't know that till I went there, really. Because I was like, that's so interesting, because I could have a character, right? If you have a bad guy, Franco Fioravanti in the novel, well, then you have a good guy, Gaetano, he's a lawyer, as he would be. He reveres St. Paul. The group was called the Blessed Society of St. Paul, the Beate Pauli. And so he will be a natural antagonist. And then other characters started to form in my mind as I traveled around Sicily. And I ended up with four main characters. And in the novel, there's four little stories that come together at a really surprising twist and then continue the story together. So I didn't know it before I went over, and I couldn't have.
So the day you're out researching and you're filming videos, and there are a lot of videos on your website, we'll get into that.
Right, later. Right. I love my website. It's so terrific. So please visit it, everyone. And an interactive map, which shows... See, every scene in this book is mapped and exists in real Sicily, and it's up there. And people in book clubs or people just want to learn more. Because I really believe readers are lifelong learners. You know, they have that as a companion piece. But anyway, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
That's okay. So when you were out there filming the videos, were you also taking notes? Like, would you sit there with a little notebook taking notes besides shooting? Because the videos, you sound so eloquent on what you're saying. I mean, I've really got to tell you. But besides that, as you're talking, were you also taking notes? Like, did you go back to the room at night and go, da, 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 I've got to have this, or it's in your head?
On the scene, right? Because you have to think on your feet a little. And also, honestly, this is the greatest job in the world because you're kind of energized. You're like, here I am. I can visualize this taking place. You know, Palermo is very modern, but there are parts of Sicily and even parts of Palermo that look ancient and medieval. And in the 1400s and the 1700s and in the 1800s, they look exactly the same. So the history, it sounds corny, but it's really true, comes to life. So when you're in that spot, you're taking notes like crazy on what you're seeing. You're taking pictures. You do it right on the scene. And in some of those videos on the website, you'll see that I'm sitting there taking notes.
Right.
I have the notepad with me. I'm just like a middle-aged lady with a legal pad. It was very much like when I was a lawyer. I don't write it when I go back to the hotel because it will be lost. I write it in the moment. And then I recorded the video because partly the book was taking shape right on in real time and thinking on your feet. I kind of like it for, I hope that people, because it makes an authenticity to the novel.
Yes.
You know, it's not like it's a travelogue. It's really like, this is what it's really like. Here's where it really happened. Here's the church where the Beate Pauli met. You can go around the side and you can go down that. We couldn't go down there because it was blocked, but I can say, this is the door they used. If you don't get jazzed by that, you should not be in this business. It's exciting.
Right.
And readers have such great imaginations that you want to give yours full bloom and theirs full bloom.
Right. And the country is much more sprawling in terrain than I had thought about. So had you been to Sicily before, or was this your first trip?
No, it was my first trip. And honestly, you know, I started off because I've been to Italy several times and said Eternal in Rome. But I didn't realize, in fact, there's a great Goethe quote. I don't know if I say his name right, but the idea is he says something like, you haven't been to Italy till you've been to Sicily, because Sicily is the key to everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's really true. It's different from Italy. It has its own dialect. It has its own food. It had its own history of colonization because of its location in this time period, right in the middle of the ocean. So all these colonizers came and took it over and sacked it, but also enlightened it and the Arabs brought irrigation, different religions occupied it. Mm-hmm. And so I had never been there. And frankly, Carol, I did not know how sprawling it was. Mm-hmm. And so that's another thing that changed when I got there. And I was like, well, let me go outside of Palermo. And you see the terrain. Palermo was irrigated by the Arabs under Muslim rule, which everybody flourished under, including Jews. But when you go outside of Palermo, you see how dry it is. Mm-hmm. You see how hard it is to farm. You understand instantly why in these early years it was so difficult to make a living. And then I said, well, now this book's really expanding, which I kind of love, because I'm like, well, you're going to need a fishing village, because fishing is so much a part of Sicily, and people make their living by fishing. What's it like to be the wife of a fisherman in Porticello in Sicily? And then you go to the Musumeli in the drier areas where there's sulfur and there's mountains, and you go, what is it like to be a Musumeli? So you set, so that's how I came up with the four characters. Two are from Palermo, but two are not. One is from Porticello, a fishing village, and the other's from a more drier area, more mountainous, dry area. Sicily has so many different, and it has Mount Etna, which didn't make its way into the book, but I was in a cave in Mount Etna, and that did make its way into the book.
And then I heard there was an earthquake after you left. There was
one week. One week we were on Aetna, and I was traveling with my bestie Laura, who's so fun and so great and more adventurous than I am because she's not afraid of heights. She's climbing that volcano. I'm back at the lodge drinking the hot chocolate, making videos of how brave she is.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
This is what crazy. I meant. It was crazy.
But you know, we all know the only thing that we know about Sicily is from White Lotus, and that was only in one part.
We stayed in that hotel. But we were much better behaved.
We were much better behaved than all the, but you can see like, you know, how funny that story was too, though. But
I know it was great. Saw, well, like,
especially that, when they go meet the relatives and the relatives don't want to know them, you know?
Yeah, really.
Travel, 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 blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So as the book opens, there are several characters and it's a different book for you because you really have to get invested in these characters and pay attention to get into the rest of the story. And there's this huge reward, like as you get to end with these characters. So we get to know something about all of them. We get enough prose that we can see them. And they're living these parallel lives. Like everything's going on, but they're not really intersecting with each other. They're all is da, 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 da. What made you choose the opening chapters like this, that we just get to meet them? And we're saying, okay, how is this going to figure in later? Because it's a different book, I think, for you, but it's a much more interesting book for smart readers.
Oh, you're so sweet. Well, it's hard. You know, how you tell the story comes out, arises from the story, and I don't plan it. So as I say, I went there and had the two guys in Palermo, the antagonist, protagonist, and the antagonist. Interestingly, the protagonist is the mafia guy. So then I was like, when I started to see these different parts of Sicily and know they had to be included, I also learned one thing that's really, really true. And I, in my historical fiction, it's all real and it's all authentic to the time. So I say to myself, Porticello, Musomelli, these other two towns that are elsewhere, don't get to Palermo. There's no intersecting of the storyline. You can do that in Rome when it's a cosmopolitan city, especially even World War II. And the three people live in a little triangle, they ping, ping, ping all off each other all the time. There's no pinging. There's pinging in Palermo, but there's not pinging between these other towns. So I said, well, you want those other two people in. What are you going to do now? And I said to myself, look, just have faith, have hope, believe in God, pray a lot, that somehow they will come together because the story will bring them together, and it does. But it wouldn't be true to the story if they met too soon. Mm-hmm. And I wanted each individual story to be interesting and suspenseful in its own right. I'm hoping you can't put this down, even though it's kind of an epic of good and evil and mafia and God and, you know, all these bigger, and what is loyalty really? You want it to be bigger things. But I loved telling each of these individual stories. You know, Alfredo, who's like a shepherd, and it's a poignant story, I think, briefly, because it's fast. I'm always dealing with law and justice and how law doesn't always lead to justice. Well, if you're going to talk about that in Sicily in the 1800s, you should be dealing with the effect of the Spanish Inquisition much earlier, which expelled Jews from the entire island and still today has the effect of having a very, very teeny tiny Jewish population in Sicily. 40,000 Jews were expelled, and ones who stayed were either tortured or executed. And there were those who hid. They were called conversos or Muranos. And my boy Alfredo is one such. He hides his Jewishness. So he can't practice it. He practices it in secret. And I wanted the poignance of that. I mm-hmm. wanted the injustice of that religious oppression. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to tell his story. He believes he is the last Jew in Sicily. In fact, he probably is. Mm-hmm. So loyalty becomes a story of the first mafia family and the last Jew in Sicily. How they meet up, I don't want to tell you, but they do. Mm-hmm. And they help each other. And without it, you wouldn't have the ending that you have, which I hope is uplifting, mm-hmm. if they didn't meet.
Yeah. Did you have a favorite to write about, Lucia, Franco, Alfredo, or Gaetano? Do you have one you were free?
I found each one my favorite. You know, you okay. kind of do. I think I specialize at this point in likable but flawed characters. And that means that I end up kind of liking them. You know, they do bad things. We understand. We get to see why the mafia was born when we see Franco's descent. Mm-hmm. You know, even him. I love that saying, the villain is the hero of his own story. He doesn't think I'm a villain. He thinks I'm a victim. And in a way he was. Mm-hmm. You know, that if you say briefly, the mafia starts out in the lemon groves around Palermo, and laborers like Franco move up to be the managers of the farm, but they have to protect the lemons on the way to market with other armed guards. And then at some point, because they can't buy land or they can't afford land, or they're not, for a long time, they're not permitted to, that they can't rise. Like we, you know, it's a principle of America. The American dream is, my family is the American dream, right? Nobody, my mother went to high school. My dad went to college on the GI Bill. Our family didn't go to college. Well, then here one decade later, one generation later, thanks to public libraries and public schooling, I get to be an author. You can rise up. I buy a house. Well, you couldn't buy a house in Sicily if you were a regular person. We can't fathom that. So I have to bring that life to life, and also how oppressive and wrong that can be. So you understand the mafia goes up violently by force because it can't lawfully. And in a way, it illustrates the purpose of the law, which is to eliminate violence and make for dispute resolution in a peaceful way. It's like, use your words.
Use your words.
But use your words. But, you know, you could talk till you're blue in the face in Sicily in the 1800s, and you're not going to be educated, and you're not, if you're poor, and you're not going to get to buy land. And if you're a woman, rot's a rock. Right. It's a woman in this book, and you see how limited the lives of women are.
Right.
And I wanted to show that.
Yeah, this is like what they can do and can't do. I'm going to get into the women a little bit too, because I have something else question about them. Were there more than four characters? Was it always four? Or do you have somebody that you're not going to work?
No, it was always four. I was like, four was all I could handle. And the
I love, you know, you have the readers reading, and we're getting, our senses are being brought together by everything from the smell of the lemons. I mean, I want to put lemons on my desk while I was like reading. It's like very, very good. And then the goat cheese. I mean, I wanted goat cheese because you're seeing this little farmer that is taking his goat cheese, and then others are not going to let him in the market, because I can say that right up front, because that's something that happens pretty early in the book. So all of a sudden you've got somebody that this is what's happening to whatever. So without being to Sicily, you couldn't have written this book, because you start imagining all these people, the lemons in the lemon grove, which I just want to go live in the lemon grove. May I go sleep there? You know what I mean?
Well, when you go there, you realize how much of it, Sicily is a sensory experience and probably was even more so then. So if I visited a lemon grove and took a video in it, which is on the website, and you smell fragrance, right. You're like, and I'm a gardener. So I kind of love all that. And you can't even believe it. And when there's lemon blossoms, you smell it. And the food is like a prickly pear. I do a Stanley Tucci tour of Sicily because I can't help but eating everything. But also I'd never have prickly pear. Now, Laura told me that was like a cool thing in drinks, but I don't know that. And when you actually pick, or a pistachio, perfect example. I've always loved pistachios. I get them in bags, right? Well, you pick it when you go to Sicily, because the character in the book is from Bronte, which is the area of Sicily that grows the best pistachios in the world. In fact, the pistachio crop is so valuable, it's only harvested every other year, that there's all these laws and government, and they have a special police force, like pistachio police. I just thought of. But it's true, because this is a real export of this, and you take, but you're, they let me pick a pistachio off a tree and eat it, and that, it's so flavorful. So if I'm not, that would have been the experience then, before all the stuff that happens in modern times.
Right.
And I have to be, I all of that's in the novel.
And did you have a little pistachio piece, police? Did they wear little green uniforms? They have little
green I don't know, they should.
I think they should have little green uniforms. We can design them for them.
Exactly. Italians do uniforms so well.
Yes.
Every cop is so, like at the Vatican, you see people. I mean, I just love Italian men in uniform. They just look hot to a man. They just look great.
Yes, because you had a real incident with the cops in Sicily.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You
can explain that before they know.
Yeah, tell that story, because it's great. It's so great about what you're doing.
Picture. I actually got my pocket picked because I'm such a dope that I had my wallet and my passport. Hello. In my backpack in Palermo when I was, you know, listening to a street band, which is probably there so that Nimrods like me will listen to it. All of a sudden I go to buy a water, my wallet's gone, my passport's gone. I have no means of identification. And of course we have to go to the police station in Palermo, which was only added to the fun, honestly. And I should have the picture. I have it over there, I think. Just like me with the police officers, which honestly, even they were super hot. It was great.
It was like, I'm so glad I lost my wallet so I can hang out.
Yeah, this cost me like $300 plus the cost of the wallet. And I had to go to Naples to get the passport renewed. But then again, we got to eat pizza at the place in Naples where they eat, pray, love, which really was great.
Yeah, and I think if I remember correctly, you got there on Columbus Day and the embassy was closed. Do I remember that?
Yes, exactly right. How ironic is that? I'm like, geez.
Can I please get back? And also flying to Sicily, I hear, is not like every hour on the hour. It's sort of like, you know, an airline that sometimes goes and sometimes doesn't, blah, blah,
right.
blah. Yeah.
Right. And you try getting on an airline with a police report because I didn't have any proof of ID to fly. So you have to go, this is my police report. Everything was stolen. They're like, okay.
Yeah.
I know.
Now we feel sorry for you. Let me give you a lemon.
The lemons are so good there that they're actually sweet. You can eat them.
See, like, lemons out of lemonade, you know, lemonade out of lemons, whatever it is.
Well, I was like, limoncello out of lemonades.
I'm going to send you some of the prickly pear stuff. It's really good. It does mix.
Okay.
And I'm not, I don't really drink. But I put it in like ginger beer. Like it's like ginger ale. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'll send you.
What's the
one place in Sicily that you would love to go back to? Is there one place that you said, I'd go here again?
Yes, Agrigento. We went there very briefly, and that's the Greek influence. And because I wanted to see, Alfredo is from Agrigento. So that's how crazy I am. I need to see the birthplace of the characters, even though it's a 4-hour drive.
But I wanted a character.
And there's a lot of Greek influence there. And there's a very famous temple and columns, which I saw, but I only saw for, you know, an hour at a distance. And I was like, this is because it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's remarkable. But I didn't have the time. I just was like, so I would go back there. A lot of tourists go there. It is very cool. But I was so busy going off the beaten track places. You know, for the book, you need to be like in a town that hasn't changed from the 1800s. Well, believe it or not, they exist.
Right.
I mean, thank God, because you can put that in the book, but you don't get to go to like Agrigento.
You don't go that far off, not 4 hours.
Right.
It's really 4 hours away. 4 hours away here would be like we'd be going past Washington, be down in North Carolina or something like that. It's crazy.
All across Sicily, we went everywhere. And the other thing is, Sicily is so hilly when you get outside of Palermo. So that if you're traveling to Musomeli, which is at the top of a mountain, it could be 2 miles, but it zigzags the whole way. And besides the fact that you're completely nauseated, it takes you much longer.
Right. It's longer to go do everything.
Yeah.
You slip in things like most Sicilians did not know how to read or write. Mm-hmm. Thus, readers understand so much that happens in person because the communication was often by gestures and a glance, because it's not the same as getting something written. And it's also in person, which can become more volatile. You send a note, it's a totally different experience. And I think learning that one little fact that they couldn't do that and they'd go to people to do their writing for them. And the dons would mete out praise and punishment physically in person with a hug or a knife. So we've got so much happening. Did this lack of education give you the opportunity to put more action into the book? Because there's not this written stuff going back and forth between people. Let me send a letter by coach, you know?
Yeah. No, that's a really interesting point you're making, and I appreciate that. I think it's really true because part of it was, it led me amazingly into the action, but also even better to me into Alfredo's character and the character, because probably two of these characters can read. Maybe Franco can read and Gaetano can read. But Sicily was behind all of Europe with its illiteracy. So then what ended up happening was everywhere I went, everybody's telling stories about their family, you know, you're talking to people. And also that the stories are getting told. And around that time, I started to read the folk tales of Giovanni Petri, because he went all around in that same time period, right? And collected folk tales. And what I learned was if you can't read a book, you can still tell a story. Mm-hmm. And everybody who grows up in, I think, families of ethnicity have this, because a lot of ethnicity comes from, I'll speak from my own background, you know, if you're gonna come from a kind of basically illiterate Italian background, they're still gonna tell you stories. Mm-hmm. And the stories are gonna have a motto that's about a way to live, you know, so Alfredo is almost a folkloric character, because I could read 100, and I did, folk tales of Sicily to get the flavor of village life. Mm-hmm. The period literature is, you're going to read The Leopard, which is a classic, probably the best-selling book. I think it is the best-selling book in Italy, written by a prince about being a prince in Sicily at the time period of loyalty, invaluable research. Mm-hmm. But you also have to read the literature of the common people as told to a man who could read and write. And that was a whole dimension for me. That's why I knew I couldn't give Alfredo short shrift. I really wanted the story of what happened to the Jews of Sicily in the novel, but I also wanted the aspect of how do you learn to live if you can't read stories about how to live? Well, you tell stories about how to live. How great is that for people who love books just to hear that?
Exactly. And then you've got each character's experiencing decisions that need to be made quickly. So there's not time to say, how do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel? They're just in their head going, this is what I must do now. This is how I must to survive. Right. It's about survival.
And it's very mafia, truly, to become a man of action. You flash forward to Mussolini. He was big on, you know, real men act. And there's a little of that with Franco. There's not going to be a lot of discussion. You always know where you stand. He's either, vis-a-vis loyalty, you're either with him or you're against him. And if you're against him, you might get dead.
Right.
So, and you understand why he becomes that person. And he has a relationship to his brother, who's his twin, but also has this darkness and light interplay within him. Mm-hmm. And they're going to try to work that out. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is action, not words. And it's, for me, I think it's also a break for a modern reader, because it is for a modern writer. Like in a typical thriller these days, somebody's going to sit in front of a computer and kind of sleuth that out. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't have, and I'm kind of relieved. You know, here's my phone, got to be with your phone at all times. Well, nobody's looking at that. And it's kind of nice because it throws you back on your own resources as an author. You're standing there in the middle of the driest part of Sicily going, well, he's got to get from point A to point B. What would he do? How would he figure it out? Who would he go see? And so you get a lot of, like you point out, you get a lot of go and talk to somebody, act on somebody, avenge somebody, arrange an army, go fight, all these big, dramatic, almost set pieces. It becomes, for me, it felt operatic. And I was kind of digging it, quite honestly. I love it. It's drama. Yeah. It's drama. And it's, you can't write about Sicily without drama.
And it's different from the drama at the beginning of the Bennets, because I always talk about this at the beginning of the Bennets, and I said, now we're on page 9, like this much has happened. Page 25, this much. This is a different book because you're getting invested in the characters first before you go like this.
Right.
The story takes off. And it's a different kind of pacing. So for you as an author, it's that sit back kind of a thing and say, I can't do what I did in the last book. I can't even do what I did in my last historical fiction, Eternal, because these people can't walk and see each other all the time. How am I going to tell their stories and how do I weave them together?
So Exactly. Although you made me sound more thoughtful than I really am, Carol. I appreciate that.
Steal my line.
I love these interviews.
I see what I did. Oh, how nice.
Oh, that was, oh my God, Carol, that's right. What you said. I couldn't even repeat it. What she said.
But you know what's really funny is, when I used to talk about the Bennets, I would say, I'm only on page 9. Now I'm on page 25. And it's a different kind of thing when you're writing a thriller, yet this has very thriller aspects to it as well.
I hope so.
Including that, I do love this line. Violetta, who's one of the women in the book, she's not one of the four principal characters, at one point says that she has the privacy of her thoughts. If your mind is free, you can go anywhere. And that's such a powerful idea. Because I think these people were trapped, but in their heads, they could go wherever they wanted to go. They could try whatever they wanted to try.
In a way, they're all outsiders. And I didn't plan this. This is what I love about like the human brain, honestly, because that's why it's always go with your gut, which my mother always said to me, go with your gut and be yourself. And people who are writing, and I hope they're listening to this, you know, you go with what your brain gives you, because I swear to God, your brain's giving it to you. When I started writing these four characters, at some point, I remember I thought, these are all outsiders. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't sit there and go, let me pick an outsider. Not at all. Mm-hmm. I just said, well, that idea sprang to me, and maybe these are the common threads. Now I forget your question because I don't think I answered, but I thought it was a really good question.
It's about talking about, she has the privacy of her thoughts. If her mind is free, you can go anywhere. So in their heads, they could be whoever they wanted to be, but in life, they were trapped.
Right. And trapped is such a key point because in a way, you know, they're all trapped by circumstances. Mafalda, who's the mother, is trapped by the village and the expectations of her, which makes her go out. Our beloved Alfredo, the Jew, the last Jew in Sicily, is trapped. He basically ends up in caves, but he's in hiding. And both Franco is trapped in a role, kind of. And Gaetano is trapped because he has a legacy that he wants to live to. which is St. Paul, which is so remarkable. But what I was thinking about when I wrote that too, and I was feeling her so much, and there's people, we've talked about the videos you can see, but like when I went to Bulgaria, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but I think it's Bulgaria, which is a town outside of Palermo. And I was there on a Sunday afternoon, and this is modern. The only people on the street were men. This mm-hmm. is small town Sicily, because the women after church were all inside. And I couldn't believe it. That happened in a lot of the small towns. And I wanted to illustrate that. I thought to myself, this is very interesting, because even in Sicily, where the terrain is like ruggedly beautiful, dramatically beautiful, anywhere you look, you're like, that's incredible. And especially so that would have been true then, because there's no development. The women are interior. Mm-hmm. They live interior mm-hmm. lives. Mm-hmm. They learn to live in their head. And I thought a little bit, what's that remind you of? And I thought of a reader. Mm-hmm. Because to a certain extent, like you're in my family room now. It's my family room. That, by the way, is my signed book collection. That's only signed, right? The real books that are you just buy are all in other rooms in the house. And readers live in their imagination for that time. That's what we love about reading, mm-hmm. I think. So it, especially with historical fiction, because like this is going to take you there and you're going to experience it and you're going to be on horseback and gallop across the plains of Sicily, or you're going to eat delicious prickly pear. All of those experiences you're going to have, I hope, because mm-hmm. I tried to describe them, imagine them really well. And as Stephen King says, reproduce them for the reader.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, this is what is going to be happening. This is how you're going to feel when you're there.
Right.
You know, there's a great line where Franco is told by Senora Esposito that after you lose the women, sooner or later, you lose the men. And while these women, we'll stay on the subject of women here for a minute, are subservient, it's clear that they too have power. Probably they don't throw spaghetti on the table if it's like they're not happy that day. In another place, Lucia says women have much more sense. So this is how we're seeing the women. The men are on the street, but the women still have these big ideas inside. And when they put their fists down on the table and say, no, this is not what you should be doing, often the men later come to listen. Not right away, right. But later.
Right. And I kind of love that, because I think, look, the hard thing is you can't have anybody act out of, no one can act out of character or out of time. So no man is going to turn on like they would nowadays and go, you know, honey, you're right. You know, I mean, I'm sure Tom will turn to you and say, yeah, you were right about that. Yeah. Well, that ain't going to happen, especially when you have a so-and-so mafia as mm-hmm. Franco. Mm-hmm. But Senora Esposito is his housekeeper, and she's older, mm-hmm. and she has his number. And so she's brave enough, and I think that happens, frankly, to women as we get older. You know, we spend a lot of time, I'll speak for myself. I people pleased for a lot of time. Still, mm-hmm. I do fight that now. I kind of want to go on, what I really think is this. Mm-hmm. Well, I think as you get older, as a woman, you learn that being people pleasing doesn't really get you anywhere. And you've been sitting on your own soul your whole life. Mm-hmm. So you stop doing it. You go, this is what I really think. So she's at that point. It's probably like age 50 in the 1800s. I didn't specify her age. She can speak to a mafia chieftain who will become the first mafia chieftain and go, you are out of line with that. You know, pay attention to, it's John Adams, right? His wife always said, like, don't forget about the women.
Yeah.
Because who you lay down with on the pillow, and women are not, when they feel secure enough in homes, are going to say, I don't trust him. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She correctly says to Franco, who listens to no other woman, mm-hmm. She's a very maternal role, you need to shore up your goodwill with the women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're gonna flip your friends who are gonna come and kill you. And I didn't foresee that. She was a throwaway character to me. And I kind of like how that happens, because you get her, and then all of a sudden you go, well, this woman and this, in fact, I like that he hires her, and her present boss wants to fire her because she won't listen. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of like, I basically hired a maid who isn't gonna take orders. But she comes into full bloom, runs his household, comes pretty close to running him, and gives him really good advice.
Mm-hmm. I love what he does when he has to woo the women. That was one of my favorite scenes, of how he wooed the women and then how he wooed the men. I mean, it's really, really funny.
Well, it's hard for him, because a little bit he's the origin of toxic masculinity. So it's
right.
You know, if your job, so do it or I'll kill you, isn't as can be persuasive in some cases, but it's the old, am I going to use any sugar with this? And she's like, let me show you how you can do this. Mm-hmm. And he actually learns to be manipulative. He's not manipulative in the beginning. He's a little bit more sledgehammery.
Yeah. And then he realizes, oh, wait, what do I have to do? Either I'm not going to have anybody behind me because I sledgehammered them all out, you know?
Exactly. Maybe I can finesse this a little better than I am.
So loyalty's got four sections, four, part one, part two. Part... In fact, my husband was reading because I'm on part three. So I was like, oh, very good. You know, you're going through your parts. Okay. And how did you define the book?
What a good like boy. That? You're so supportive.
How did you going through that? How did you define the book like that? Was that in the original writing? Did that come as part of the editing process of, I've got this, 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 and this? And I ask you this because I interviewed William Landay a couple of weeks ago about his new book. And his new book's in four parts. And three and four have actually different punctuation. And if you're a smart reader, you're reading it and you're realizing they just didn't take out any of the stuff. That was a reason for doing that. Were there reasons for these four sections as you were going through in your brain to define it?
You know, honestly, I have a little bit of a part. I've noticed it in myself. I have an urge to put things in parts. And sometimes I write the first draft in parts and then I take them out. This required it because the precipitating action to loyalty, and we're not giving anything away, it's the first page, is that there is a big festival of Saint Rosalia going down Palermo. She is the city's patron saint, which is effectively the capital city. It's the biggest festival in Sicily. And a little boy is there with his very wealthy parents, and he is kidnapped that night and thrown into a madhouse, which I actually visited. And that was part of the reason I wanted to write this too. It was so fascinating. And all that's on the website. So he's thrown into the madhouse. And then the 1800s, you can imagine, the treatment for a mental illness is awful. If you have mental illness, you're called a lunatic. You're basically chained to a wall. At that point, and it's really true history, they were in a convent of St. Teresa. So they were with tubercular people, syphilitic patients, and also lepers. Mm. So that's where he's thrown, a young child. So the question begins, is he going to get out? Is anybody going to save him? That's the action, top line action. Now, when I started to write it, I started to realize that I was going to have to jump action. We won't tell any reasons why, but I had to jump about a 15-year period. So I thought to myself, that's a natural break for a part. Mm-hmm. That should be the second part of the book. And readers understand that. So bring everybody to a certain point, leave them with, oh my goodness, is this kid going to get rescued? What's going to happen? And then jump. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of was getting part happy. I just love it. We won't show bored people, but I got like beautiful lemons in the part sections.
Yes. Yes.
And I was like, wait a minute. If I can do that, then little Lisa, who loves, is such an English major. You know, here's a good quote. I'll read it. Permit me. This is a quote from the 1800s. The head of Palermo police once remarked to me, were a cross to be placed on every spot where a victim lies buried in the plain of Palermo, the Concadoro, which is that area, would be one vast cemetery. That was what people said about the mafia by 1900s. Well, then I get to say, oh, here's a real description of the madhouse by the Baron who actually started and changed the whole shape of psychiatry in Sicily because of his own life story, which we can talk about if you want. But in answer to the question, I was like, if you can have two parts, why can't you have four? And I got four parts and I kind of love it.
Yeah, and by the fourth part, you're seeing everything coming together too. You're seeing how the characters meld and how these lives collide. And
right.
But you get that payoff because you've paid attention or you've been so raptured. I was like, you know, oh, wow, look at what these people did. Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a different kind of structure to the storytelling. But I think it's the only thing you could do if your scope, if you're trying to tell the story of Sicily a little bit in a microcosm and the rise of the mafia in a microcosm and the oppression of other people in the microcosm. And also in the weird way, and I'll just say how crazy I am, that when I was in Sicily and learning all this stuff and thinking all this stuff, I thought Sicily is a microcosm of the world writ large. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's kind of crazy when you think about world history and the idea basically that there's people and they try to live and then they get colonized by richer people. And then even richer people come and beat and kill those people and come in and there's layers of colonization. Oh, every country has that experience, including our own.
Right.
So I was like, well, that's your girl. You know, if what's that quote about if heaven's reach is beyond your grasp, what's a heaven for? Of course, try to tell a big story.
How to go big.
How long are you going to live, man?
Right. Right. And you know, the word loyalty comes up and again in the book. You're in the middle of a sentence and it's loyalty. Again, it's this. The word implies so much. Were you purposeful in including it as time went on? Like, did you say, really, this is a whole thing about loyalty, or it was just natural? It was there.
Because I just wrote it and I didn't change it, because I will tell you secretly that the first title of the book was Sacred.
Okay.
I was going to use the title Sacred because it was really about what is sacred. I feel like these lights are so bright. What did I do here? But the funny thing is, and this is behind the scenes that you'll get out of me, that Sacred on the cover, when they sent it to me, it didn't look like a good word. You know, mm-hmm. Some words look funny, large. And I was like, that doesn't look, what's sacred? And then I was like, what's this book really about? And then I started looking at it. I was like, practically it's all, and the mafia is certainly about loyalty. And I love that notion, because honestly, I think loyalty is generally a good thing. Mm-hmm. I regard myself as a loyal person, but all around us, we see examples of when loyalty is a bad thing. Certainly the mafia is an example of loyalty being a bad thing. It built the mafia. It also perpetrated violence and death. Mm-hmm. Gaetano was loyal to his God and his favorite saint. That's good. Alfredo is loyal to his goats and his religion. Mafalda is loyal to her child. People will feel this, and I hope it will resonate at an emotional level, but I didn't plan it. I actually planned something else.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really interesting seeing this and seeing loyalty here. Sacred would be in red to me. Sacred would be a word. It would never be in yellow, sacred. And it doesn't feel like the place where you felt the arid, the lemons and all this stuff. And it's so funny because many times we sit there and we talk about, oh, like, is this really the title all along? And people go, no, it was either untitled. It was something in your head, completely different. But sacred and loyalty are really a lot of the same things. You're loyal to things you feel sacred about. You're sacred. Exactly. So it all chimes in. So the cover, did you, like, were there a lot of iterations? Because
let me tell you something, it's amazing, because I do think this is where I think your brain comes through and people's imaginations and everybody somehow, because I love my publisher Putnam. And they sent me a lot of different covers. This was the only iteration of that one. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, holy God in heaven.
That's it.
Because also what was happening a little bit was I was feeling gold. When I go to Sicily, the sun, right? It's like today, it's so sunny, mm-hmm. and it's so lemony, and they love lemon. So they make a lot of lemon food, and everywhere you look, that texture that's on the cover, I actually requested mm-hmm. that they use paper instead of plastic. You hear
right.
It has the feeling of Sicily, a Sicilian wall, a plaster based. You can see this was detailed that this genius art department came up with. Anthony Rotuno is his name. It's just brilliant. And my editor, who's so great, Mark Tavani. And they had these ideas. And I was like, see, I don't really necessarily think visually that way. And but I thought, I think tactily. I'm a big hugger. But I'm like, this is really cool. So there was no better cover. There wasn't a, if you only you do this. It was just, this is sensational.
Yeah.
It's very much a piece.
And it's very interesting. That was a different title and you were writing to something different. Your loyalty was throughout the whole book like this. It's not like you went back and said, what's now because of the title, go back and put 20 words of loyalty in the book. No.
Everything with me is organic. Right. That's part of the not planning. If you didn't plan it, the truth is it never turns out wrong. What was wrong was me titling it Sacred. I hadn't really realized that until I started writing it, because I had ideas when I was over there. And then, you know, sometimes you look at what you did, like I'm saying with the, that they're all outsiders, for example. I didn't go, let's think of who are outsiders. That makes it formulaic and you're filling in blanks, and I'm never doing that. It's only like, what would your brain give you? Mm. That's what I want to say to younger readers or new readers, you know, trust yourself, because you'll say that's the right idea. Mm-hmm. Like the first guess is always right, like they taught you about the SATs. That's true. Mm-hmm. Because your brain's trying to work with you, and don't get in its way. Let it tell you what it's going to tell you and believe it. Have faith.
Yeah. Be loyal to your own thoughts.
Exactly. Be loyal to yourself. Look at you, Carol.
Look at that. So,
do you really? God, you pulled that right out of your butt, girl. You're right. We're going on Oprah.
We'll go on tour together. We'll go on tour together. I'll feed you the lines. I'll feed you the lines.
I'm going to steal the line, but I will credit you. Okay?
No. Steal the line. Steal the line. So would you write on a schedule? Okay, you get back. You get back from Sicily, October 2021. You unpack. You put the stuff away. Then what do? You sit down and start writing? You write on the plane?
You can't even wait. Right. Because then all this, you keep reading too, because like the plane ride, because all of the books you're reading now, you picture the setting more. It makes sense. And you go, as soon as you hit the ground, honestly, you can't even wait. I hadn't written anything before I left. And I just started. And it wrote really, it was not easy because there's a lot of moving parts in this book. And they come, and I was like, I know they're going to come together. I just feel it in my soul. But I didn't know how necessarily.
Right.
And so you're in a state of high anxiety. You're like, oh no, you should have written with an outline, Lisa. Enough of this fly by the seat of your pants stuff and must be organic BS, you know. Oh God, could it be not so organic? Maybe you would have, you know, but you just start writing and you write every day.
Right.
I love that. That's what I do. I mean, I live alone. I'm very lucky in this life with my dogs and my cats and little pony outside. And I love my job.
So you'll just sit down and write. You'll get up in the morning. You'll write. Do you have a time? Like I stop at 6, I do this. Not really.
I write 2000 words a day minimum. Okay. Okay. So that's my stop. Usually that seems to end by 6, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it doesn't come until I need a dinner break. I eat and then I get a dinner break and I make such a big deal of my meals. It's so funny because my daughter will call me and go, honey, I need to eat. I can't even talk on the phone right now. I'm going to be mindful of this is my little treat. I'm going to eat mindfully. So I feel like I ate. This is my little treat. My brain rests. And I'll call her later when I've done my, you know, unless it's really important. She's like the only call I take. But then, you know, sometimes I have to work at night because I didn't get half of the 2000, I didn't get 1,000 words in the daytime.
Right, right. And the dogs sometimes are sitting there looking like she's relaxing now. We can be really bad.
I do walk. I take them on a walk. And a lot of times I'll get ideas about the chapter on a walk and I'll actually dictate. I've actually dictated on walks. I dictate notes and reminders. I go, oh, this is what really should happen. And then when I go home, I know what I'm going to do. Walking is really good for people who need to think,
I seem to be trapped in my office most of the day, but if I go downstairs to do something like laundry, like sometimes I'm stuck and I said, yes. I'm going to go like yes. bed. I'm going to go fold laundry because your brain just changes. And the listeners have heard me say this umpteen times. I miss long flights because I would majorly have thoughts on long flights. My brain would like wake up, you know?
I agree. And I don't know why that is. I've gotten book ideas on flights. And I don't know if it's you're on the, I don't know what it is. And I don't even like to fly, but when it's a long flight, I'm like, fine with me.
You're free from everything. Your meal is going to come. You're going to get the choice of this bad food or that bad food. It's very easy. It's very easy.
Yeah, you can't wait. Yeah, you're still like, why did that row get it? Are they going to have any pasta left? I'm always like in suspense on planes. I hate that. I'm like, feed me, ladies.
We don't fly first class very much. We flew out to Colorado one time and they ran out of food. And I'm like, I'm in first class. How could you have run
out? That's outrageous in first class. Like you pay extra grand for this ticket, like bring me the crappy spaghetti.
I use the miles to get this. Lots of miles. Like I should be getting more. Probably because I use miles. They probably check that box off. So there's also this whole generation that you're writing to that never saw The Godfather, never saw The Sopranos. My younger son is 28 and watched The Sopranos. He goes, oh, that was a really good show. I'm like, really? Just catching up now, you know? And it's really funny. We blew going to a swim club when I was growing up in North Caldwell. And it's right in the area where Tony Soprano was. And we realized one day the basketball court is where Tony Soprano's house is. They sold it. It became a development. And it's the funniest thing. We're driving by. We go, that's where it's really funny. So, but they're wondering, like, what is this all about? What are you talking about, the mafia? Mafia, it seems like, I don't know. It seems like gangs are bigger now and the mafia is quieter. Maybe I'm crazy. But it seems like, you know, gang violence is what we're hearing about more than there was a body that might be buried in, you know, like the Giants stadium. You know what I mean? And I don't feel like we're hearing stories about that. Like I remember when Gotti died and there were those huge flower bouquets and he was paraded through the streets. Am I crazy that I'm not hearing about the mafia quite the same way anymore?
Well, you know, I watch this stuff all the time because it's my job too. And I love it. And the mafia exists. I do think if you're looking writ large, what gets media attention? Random violence. It's the difference between organized crime and disorganized crime. disorganized crime will always get more attention because it could be you. Yeah. That's why in the Bennetts, I actually used a carjacking.
Right.
Because that could be you.
Right.
But really, if you know the facts, you know that it gets more attention, but there's relatively fewer. Mm-hmm. Our imagination runs wild with disorganized crime, cartels, whatever. Oh, tourists went to Mexico and got attacked. That could be me. Probably won't be.
Right.
And I only say that because I've lived in Philadelphia all my life, which we have our share of the mafia related activity. And once I was in a restaurant, the next night there was a hit at that restaurant at the table next to me. Well, but what's interesting about that is I don't feel threatened by them because we know who they want to shoot and it's not me. The violence is not random.
Right.
But what the truth is in terms of the principle is that the relationship of law to justice and law to crime is something I want to look at, whether it's disorganized crime or organized crime. Why you need law is to stop both of these things, because both crimes oppress normal people and make them miserable, whether you randomly got hit or they're just stealing your money and money laundering it, and a corporation will do it too, and politicians will do it too, and white collar crimes will do it too. All of that crime is still not good for people like us. Mm-hmm. And we need law to assert our right and protect us against them. So that's what's kind of lurking in the subtext of loyalty.
Mm-hmm. It's everyday kind of thing. Because you're on the news every night and you're hearing something like, oh, that could be me. Oh, that could be me. Oh, that's so terrifying.
Right. You know, right. But you know, you might want to ask yourself why you're paying so much for pharmaceuticals, or right. Why insulin cost above $13 for all of your life. Right. Well, there's criminality in that. Just because it's real organized doesn't make it less criminal.
Exactly. And you start looking at things every day. We also have these days, these true crime people trying to solve everything that's going on. And that's right. A whole other thing that's affecting, like, you know, thriller writing at this point, because everybody.
I use that in Bennett's.
Yeah. It's like, oh, let's go. Yes, exactly. We'll find them. We'll know what to do. Sometimes they're on it and sometimes they're not. Sometimes exactly. They do a great job. Of the police don't have to talk because everybody else is talking. So great, go with that theory. It's not close, but keep going, folks. You know?
Yeah.
All right, so now you do all this writing and then you start editing and then you start pairing back. Do you overwrite and then you have to go chop, 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 chop? Or
yeah, I try not to, and anyone writing should understand that. You just don't get in your own way with the first draft. Just try to, you're telling yourself the story. And if you're like me, you don't have the outline, you're like, what's gonna happen next? You just need to get that down. You don't need to worry about if your verb is the right choice or if this is too long. I think I'm basically a nice person. And first draft is like mine being nice. And then second draft is this dark side of me that I become like such a total bitch, honestly. and I just become like, why is this sentence here? Like someone else wrote it. What an idiot she is. Get that out of there. You know, you start to like, oh, your self-hate. No, but actually I don't think of it that way. I think of it like the sentence has to justify itself. Mm-hmm. Because even though I'm writing in a different genre in theory and historical fiction, I'm known for fast-paced books. Mm-hmm. I can't write a book that somebody will go, you know, it has to move fast. And the key to a story moving fast is editing. Mm-hmm. That's second draft worries, which are your favorite worries in the world because you know you already have a story. Second draft, you just want to, I always say, and my daughter now, who's a novelist in her own right, Francesca, always says, get it down, then get it good. That's a good formula. That's true. Get it down, then get it good.
Right. So when does Mark see it? When does your editor see it? Not till it's good.
No. I don't even really talk to him about it. He's wonderful.
Right.
He's always there for me.
Yes.
You know, sometimes I'll go, I'm thinking about this. And he'll go, yeah, that about that. And we have a wonderful exchange, which is really a nice thing.
Right.
And also bounce a lot of ideas off Laura, who's super helpful, my bestie and assistant. She's great, you know, and especially since she had been there with me. Remember that? If they turned that corner, would that work? She, yeah, that would work. It's nice to have people. And I even bounce ideas off my daughter.
Right.
But nobody official sees it. No one sees it.
Right.
Until, especially my publisher, because my job is still to knock his socks off, and that's what I want to do.
Well, and also Mark is also very comforted, I'm sure, by those phone calls. He goes, "Woof, I guess she is really writing." Because you know, so many times they don't really like. Okay, she's really like halfway through. I guess I don't need to. I can relax. Oh, okay, she's got the first draft done. Because a lot of times, there is this moment of suspense in publishing of what is happening with this book that we have a date for coming out. I mean, sure. I've got to know this. This is like,
I'm sure they're scared out of their gourd. I am too. I'm sitting there going, you don't have an outline. I hope you have a story. All I can do, and I say this to beginning writers, I even said it to my daughters, just work on it every day.
Yeah.
It's like they say about, you know, your closet's a mess. Okay, well, do your shoes. And then tomorrow, your sweaters. You can't do the whole thing. You can't go, nobody would sit down and write a novel and go, I can write a novel. I still don't think that, and I've written 35. I don't think that. I go, the question really is also, can you write this novel? Mm-hmm. Can you tell this story? And that's not even an evil inner voice that tells you that. That's real truth. Especially if you're trying to change it up each time so that you keep it fresh for the reader. And honestly, for yourself.
Right.
I want to do something really different and cool every time. I feel like in Loyalty, I'm swinging for the fences. That's what I'm trying to do.
I like that idea that you only do certain things. Okay, I'm going to do this corner of my office today. That's it. I'm going to say, right. Lisa said that's all I need to do. And my husband comes up and goes, you still got the stuff on the floor. I'm going to go, but he said, she said. But well, we're not going to tell him that. He's going to have to do his whole office. He has to do the whole thing. It's. I want to decorate it. It's not good. So the audio is narrated by Eduardo Balerini, and he's done many of your books before. What do you appreciate about him as an audiobook performer? And they are performers. He's performing your work.
That's not an accident that he's done them, because I request him and then I beg. And I don't want you to think like I know him like some big fixes in. I had heard him read before. He is one of, I love audiobooks. I'm an audiobook freak. I could show you on my phone. When I walk the dogs, I listen every time. And the funny thing is, this is a little writer hint, that you could be listening to an audiobook and I'll get an idea for what I'm writing. So something is unlocked in your brain. I'm just telling you, it's the motion, it's the audiobook, it's my secret sauce. So why he is so good? So he read the two main characters that were men in Eternal. I requested him because also he's born in Italy. He's an Italian speaker. He speaks beautiful Italian, and he gets it. He's a poet. He's been an actor. He was in The Sopranos, and I never forgot him. I'm like, oh my God, I remember this part. So then he was so amazing, and of course I choose audiobooks a lot by who reads them, like many buyers do. Mm-hmm. I buy my audiobooks. I'm my best customer, practically. I send my audiobook to everybody, and you can send gifts. It's great. And so then I asked for him for the Bennets, What Happened to the Bennets, which was, you know, because, and he did an amazing job with that too, because he has, so why? So then I asked him for Loyalty, and even though there's a female part, I said, he can do women. I've heard him do women. I have a short story on Amazon about the Mary D'Annunzio little clan. He can do old men. Mm-hmm. You become to understand that an audiobook, I'm supposed to be good at words. I've yet to find the word to describe it, but the closest is a performance. Mm-hmm. It is a performance, and it is a performance of a show by one man. Mm-hmm. So it is virtuosic. It is not like anything else in the world. So he will do all the voices of all the characters and bring a little soul, act each one. Mm-hmm. You can visualize it. He brings it, he truly brings it to life in the best way. Mm-hmm. Because it also involves the reader's imagination. In the cool news, I should mention here for the first time that What Happened to the Bennets, to switch gears for a minute, has a TV deal. Mm-hmm. It will actually be on TV. Mm-hmm. The first time in 35 years I've actually gotten anything that looks like it's getting made, which is, I get optioned a lot, but not made. That's wonderful. And why it's relevant here is because it'll be interesting for me to see, because an audio, as happy as I am about that, the TV deal, that is, it will bring people to the books. Hopefully they'll watch the show and love it. It's a great story. But an audiobook allows for your imagination in a way that a visual version does not, right? They're going to show you how it happens. Well, Edward, I'm going to write it, and Edward is going to perform it. And it's just incredible. This audiobook of Loyalty is incredible. The audiobook he did of Eternal is incredible. Of Bennett's is incredible. I hope to God that I can get him every way, everything I write, because I would die happy. And I think he really gets these Italian themed things that I'm doing in a way that's soul related.
And it's authentic. He sounds authentic as he's doing it.
That's what I mean to say. That's the word.
So what's next for you? Okay, so you've got to be writing the book for next year, right? So at the same time, you're at yapping about loyalty, speaking eloquently every place, doing this, going here, going there. The next book is hatching.
It is it is 70,000 words done, baby. It's the first draft. I shouldn't say the title. I did the other night and I was like, that's not for sure, but I kind of love it. So I'm not going to say it yet. Cause it could be like sacred where it looks funny on the thing. You're like, that looks funny. Like you can't even believe that that's the problem you're having, but it did. But I'm super excited about that too. I love the ability to write what I want. Thanks. And that comes thanks to my readers who will follow me. Cause I love that. You know, I look at the reviews on Goodreads and elsewhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and it will say things like, you know, I love her mysteries. I'm not really a historical fiction person, but I love Eternal. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing that on the advanced reads of Goodreads too. Mm-hmm. You know, I expected the characters to be all together at the beginning, but then this happens and that was so cool. You know, people are smart. Readers are smart, and my readers are the smartest. Yeah. So you and I believe that. I mean, we're talking to each other at soul level. So I forgot what the question was.
But no, it's like, what's next for you? But you know, it's interesting when you read the reviews. It's like you're reading your reader mail. Seriously, it's really like the same thing. But they don't think they're talking to you because sometimes they'll say something there that they wouldn't say to your face. They'll say something I read all our reader mail and I answer all the reader mail. And as you do that though, you get an idea of something to do in the newsletter. You get an idea of something you're going to do because you're realizing that there's this whole group that doesn't understand something. So you need to explain that this is why you're doing it. And it's like, now next book, I'll know that this is what I need to do. Next book, not this book.
Who knew? Go figure. Listening works. It's good. You know, and I get a lot of email. I try to answer as much as I can. I can't answer all of them because I would never write.
Right.
But the email is usually really, terrific. They'll say nice things. Sometimes I didn't like this part.
Right.
And you see a remarkable consistency between the email, which is private, and the reviews. People will say online exactly what they think.
Yes.
And you know what? They should. Yeah. I'm bulletproof. If they didn't like something, I want to know that. Mm-hmm. I might not change it, but I might. Next book out. Still writing. I'm not,
Like you haven't done this. You haven't done that yet. Okay, fine. All right. You know, got it.
Right.
I love this. I'm so glad I got to read it already, but people are in for a treat because they haven't gotten to read it already. It's going to be so much fun. You are doing some events. You're doing some virtual
first time
events.
First time in four years.
And that's a long time for you because you like
it. I miss it. I love it. I miss my readers. I miss the bookstores. I'm going to great independent bookstores and a Barnes & Noble, which I also love. And it'll be great. I just wanted, we're going to keep it safe. And I'm just really, really thrilled about that. And I have virtual events too. Everyone should look at my website, which will have these videos, the interactive map, and the virtual events for book club people and non-book club people, because we leave no reader behind.
You leave no reader behind. That is definitely the Scottolini motto. I leave no readers behind.
Include all. Be open your arms and heart. Love everybody. That's me.
That's you, definitely. Lisa, it's always a pleasure. Today was a really special pleasure. We're pre-pub. I haven't even heard when anybody else was asking you about the book. I said, I'm going with my gut about what I want to know from her. You know,
that's good questions. And so interesting. I hadn't thought about the parts either. I'm like, she's right. I do. I love parts.
Four parts. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Carol.
And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks To, whether you're on YouTube, watching us on our YouTube channel, the Book Report Network, or on our podcast, which is Book Reporter Talks To.
We all love the Book Reporter and we appreciate you so much. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you. And Tom too. Yes. And Tom too. Get him to read again. There you go.
God bless him. I love when I get the blessing from Tom.
Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Loyalty by Lisa Scottolini, narrated by Eduardo Ballerini, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. This show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, listen to an audio excerpt from Loyalty by Lisa Scottolini, narrated by Eduardo Ballerini.
Palermo, Sicily, 1810. It was the final night of the Festival of Saint Rosalia, and hundreds of people lined Via Toledo, cheering, praying, and singing hymns. Priests led the procession, holding tapers that glowed like halos in the darkness. Spectators looked up the street, craning their necks to see the ornate silver reliquary of the patron saint. The carabinieri faced that way too, their plumed hats in a line, their horses shifting on polished hooves. Only a bearded man looked away, down the street. Nobody noticed him in the shadows behind the crowd. He kept his eye on the wealthy families privileged to stand on the Quattro Canti, or Four Corners, which was the intersection of Palermo's two most important streets, Via Toledo, extending to the harbor, and Via Maqueda, bisecting the capital. The procession moved down the street, and the crowd's fervor intensified, anticipating the reliquary. People kissed pictures of the young saint, held roses up to her, and cheered, "Viva Palermo! Viva Santa Rosalia!" Among the privileged on the Quattro Canti, the husbands surged forward to see better, and the wives remained behind with the children. The bearded man threaded his way to a little boy standing with his mother at the back of the Quattro Canti. He snuck up behind the boy and waited for the moment to pounce. The saint's reliquary popped into view, and the crowd erupted in shouting, cheering, and weeping. The boy's mother burst into pious tears, and the bearded man made his move. He pulled a marionette from under his cloak and showed it to the boy. The boy reached for the marionette, and in one cruel motion, the man grabbed the boy and flung his cloak over him. The clamor of the crowd devoured the boy's startled cry. The marionette dropped to the cobblestones. The man ran away with the boy. The mother looked around for her son. She called him, but didn't see him anywhere. She whirled around, beginning to panic, then screamed. It was as if he had been swallowed by the crowd. She would remember this moment for all of her days. The man jumped onto a bay mare and rode off with the boy. He galloped from the city proper and raced past prickly pear cacti, cypresses, and olive trees on a road illuminated by a crescent moon. In time, he approached a dilapidated building set off by itself, a boxy, broken shadow in the night. It was the Ospizio di Santa Teresa, a madhouse that held lunatics, lepers, and the poor.